papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mr.
Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we talk about what's going on in newsrooms around America and some of the ethical standards that are brought to bear with some veteran journalists who might have some observations about that. Let me introduce us. I'm Rex Smith of the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union. Here with Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady. You doing okay?
I'm good. I'm in the short chair today, but feeling spry.
Spry. There she is. And Mike Spain, formerly associate editor of the Times Union. How are you, sir?
I'm well, and I'm happy to join you folks today for what will be certainly a robust discussion about journalism.
What an optimist.
Yeah, we'll see how robust it gets to be. What's on your mind? What are you thinking, Judy?
You know, college newspapers are an important part of the news ecosystem, and I was really alarmed when I read a story about Indiana University. The media advisor was fired because the college clamped down and said, you know what? And the next issue, I want only fluff, only news about the homecoming that weekend, no real news at all, which, you know, people are counting as censorship. So I think it's not the first time this has happened. It won't be the last. I'm just worried it's going to be increasingly common.
Uh-huh. All right. We'll get back to that in a second. Mike Spain, what's on your mind?
Well, of course, the big media story this week is that Fox News and CNN and MSNBC and other big news organizations are standing together and saying no to the demand by the Secretary of Defense that media organizations sign a pledge not to really print or publish or broadcast anything that is not pre-approved by the Pentagon, which would be an enormous infringement on our freedom of speech and the First Amendment.
Great topic, actually. We definitely will get back to that in a moment. Well, I think it's interesting that we are sitting here, we who have devoted our careers mostly to local journalism, and we find ourselves often talking about the national debates, the global issues that dominate the headlines that are covered by people in national platforms. But we're focusing on what's closer to our communities, and it's what most journalists in America do, actually. I remember I heard a speech last year to some young journalists by Brian Lehrer, who's the morning host on WNYC, public radio in New York City, and he urged these young journalists, fall in love with local, which is a great thing. And yet, I want to just give you a statistic. There are too few of us now. There's a study that was released last year that created something called the Local Journalist Index, the Local Journalist Equivalents, they measure, LJEs. And they found, this is based upon estimates of reporting capacity based on publishing frequency, outlet types, geographic focus, verification. It showed that there's been a roughly 75% decline in local journalists since 2002, which just coincidentally is the year that I became the editor of the Times Union. It went from about 40 journalists per 100,000 residents to 8.2 journalists per 1,000. So if we've lost 75% of our local journalists, think about that. Some places it's higher than others. Coincidentally, the state with the most journalists, 100,000 residents, you'd be surprised, I think, is Vermont. I guess because journalists like to live in Vermont. I don't know. No, there are a lot of good nonprofit journalism outlets in Vermont. But the fact is, I think local journalism can be different from national. Howard Ziff, who used to teach journalism at UMass Amherst, wrote in the 1980s about the difference between what he called cosmopolitan journalism and provincial journalism, and that local communities, he said, benefit by having journalists who know the territory, who aren't just disengaged observers, but actually supporters of the place where they live. And so this will get into a little bit, I think, the conversation about the Indiana Daily Student and so on. But what about this notion that journalism is practiced differently locally?
Man, Rex, you broke my heart with that statistic.
Yeah.
Wow. I decided to stay in local journalism. I spent my career in local journalism in part because I loved where I lived, but I also loved the city that I covered, the cities I covered, the towns I covered. And I believed that what I was doing was just as important as covering the Pentagon or covering the White House. Maybe it was a lack of ego on my part, but I felt like this was really, really important. And I've seen the decimation of newsrooms. It is incredible the kind of stories we aren't covering and what we were able to cover all those years ago. So it's truly a loss. There's some compensation happening nowadays. You see it with other kinds of other people, citizens stepping forward a bit, but it's just not the same. One of the things I used to do at the New York Press Association was try to encourage people who were in college to consider a career in local journalism. You know, part of the problem, again, was a lack of pay, lack of health insurance. They were coming out of college with these huge debts and they needed to make some money. You know, kids out of college have always wanted to work for a magazine or work for CBS. Not so much nowadays, but but that's always been something you fight. But there was honor, and there continues to be honor in covering news, local news, and let's hope that can be rekindled in some way.
What do you think, Mike?
I remember talking to a candidate for a sports job once, and one of the things that impressed me was he says, I just love sports. I love to write about the kids that high school sports, the kids that achieve. I love to follow the teams. And at the paper he worked at in Mississippi, he said, I went with the team on the team bus to their away games and interviewed them all, and I just love telling those stories. And I think that has to be true with people who just cover general news. They just are part of a community. They love the history. They love to talk about the politics. They love to talk about the dynamics of what local companies, you know, have contributed to the community, what losses they've experienced together. And when you have somebody like that covering local news, you have an insight that's extraordinarily valuable and it's irreplaceable when they leave or retire. It's a dedication to telling the story of your community. And it's being able to be critical of it too, but not entirely. You know, it's just tell the story, tell the good stories and tell the bad stories. And that doesn't happen automatically. I think people have to dedicate themselves to that. And, you know, I was from the Watergate class. I graduated college the summer of Watergate and Richard Nixon's resignation. And, you know, we all wanted to go to Washington and we wanted to be Dan Rather and we wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein. And with all due respect, to attain that would be great, and people need to do that. But the real need is to tell what's going on in your community the same way, to investigate a scandal or follow the money or tell what's really going on. And that's the beauty of local journalism.
I remember telling a friend of mine who became a reporter for CNN and CBS News that I had decided to stay here because the people of New York's Capital Region, I said at that time, I guess you're not supposed to quote yourself, but people of New York's Capital Region, I said, deserve great journalism, no less than the people of Manhattan. But it is harder to deliver it here because we don't pay as well. Therefore, we don't draw people.
Retain people.
Yeah. And folks who are excited about living in Manhattan will say, well, I don't want to live here. I actually like living here better. Thank you. But it's harder, I think, to convince journalists to devote their lives to local coverage. But it is really the important stuff. And it does seem to me that if we could rebuild local journalism, if we can, that the lines of communication, the structure of community journalism can have an influence on reestablishing that trust with journalism that has been broken by the focus on only the national stuff. I guess what I'm trying to say is there's a credibility that attaches to knowing that the guy down the street is the one who's covering what's going on, as opposed to somebody who you've never heard of. What do you think about the difference, though, between the independence of the local journalist versus the national? Isn't there a certain bias that is built in when you're a part of the community that you're covering?
Ooh, good question. I mean, traditionally, the local newspaper has been locally owned and operated, so the local family is part of the community, and it depends on that family, whether or not how involved they are. But again, if you are living, if it's your taxes going up as well, it could have been a challenge to cover the school board meeting, but you have to disassociate yourself from your own personal interests on that. You know what? One of the things I worry about is local news organizations thinking that AI is going to be their savior. Those stories are not going to rebuild trust, reestablish credibility, bring the readers back home. And if anything, that's going to hurt. But I agree with you, Rex, about the local connections that you get with the publisher going to the Rotary Club meetings, the owner, sometimes a different person, often the same person, being involved or not. I think that can make a real difference. But it's part of the tradition of the local newspaper. It's not anything new. If anything, it's disintegrating when you see the newspapers being bought up and these small groups being established.
Yeah, it makes quite a difference.
Yeah, I can't see how a local newspaper can avoid being biased in favor of the community in which they operate. I mean, biased is a pejorative word. Maybe the better way is that they love the community that they cover. And if you love the community and you're an honest journalist, you're going to tell the good and the bad. You're going to identify what the problems are. You're going to look for solutions. You're going to promote, and promote sounds like a pejorative word when you're talking about journalism, but you're going to write about and print and publish and broadcast about people who have different ideas on how to solve problems in the community or how to bring a new company and, you know, attract new businesses, attract new residents, and to talk about those problems and write about those problems is the obligation. But I think you have to have the goal be to better the community. I mean, that is the way I've always felt about it. You tell people about what's going on in your community. You expose them to a lot of different thoughts and ideas about the community, and the community benefits from it, and you engage the community. So in a way, a local news operation is biased because they want to tell you what's going on and improve the community in the process.
Here's a listener, by the way, who writes in with a suggestion in that regard, Steve in Delmar. Well, he starts off by saying the Media Project broadcast is one of my favorites when I listen to WAMC.
Thanks, Steve.
Hey, appreciate that, Steve. Great. Your broadcast on October 8th was one of the best I've heard. Wonderful to hear the passion in Barbara's and Judy's and your voices as you discuss the dangers facing journalists and the policies of the Trump administration. One of you made the comment that reporting should not be about left or right, but rather about what's right or wrong. Well said. So Steve says he's a longtime subscriber to the Times Union and intends to contact the paper with suggestions. They run a daily article in the nature of fact-checking. What do you think about local fact-checking? We have done some of that, right? When we were at the Times Union, Mike?
Oh, we did. And it's part and parcel to reporting. It's making sure your information is correct. But to dedicate staff solely to going back and fact-checking every commercial that might be aired during a campaign and all that, I mean, it is extraordinarily expensive and difficult, and it takes away from other roles that the newsroom legitimately has to fulfill. So, yes, they should always fact check us and be skeptical of any assertions that are made by politicians. And I think that does happen. But to dedicate people to it full time and not let them do other reporting, others would lose. It's all about managing the resources in the best way you can.
You know, those fact-checking columns are so readable. Maybe it's just me, or maybe it's just an old journalist loves reading those, like you like reading corrections as well. But I also think that every article should be a fact check as well, that we just don't have the resources to do that. And fact check columns themselves can become very critical or biased. And there are probably 50 of them out there on the internet now, and each one of them carries some sort of grade of credibility, some a lot more than others.
By the way, folks, if you want to share your thoughts with us, we appreciate Steve from Del Mar doing that. media@wamc.org is how you can interact with us. media@wamc.org. I'm Rex Smith here with Judy Patrick and Mike Spain. So we were talking about impact in the community. Certainly the student media is that. And this controversy in Indiana, where the Indiana Daily Student, long one of the best college newspapers around, now is primarily digital, as is true of most college publications. And apparently the head of the director of student media was fired after he refused a directive to only have the print publication do information about homecoming and leave out all other. I know
we have to laugh at that, don't we?
Sorry. Oh, yes, let's just have information about homecoming.
How much money was spent on that homecoming? And where did it come from?
How did they elect that queen?
So it does seem like it's an immediately clear violation of free speech. And at a publicly supported university, Indiana University is run by the Board of Regents of the state of Indiana, you would think that that would be even unconstitutional, right?
Yeah, Mark Cuban, an alumni and a benefactor, is among those claiming that this isn't a violation of the First Amendment. Again, to be fair, there's always been a tension between college administrations and college newspapers. The best, in my opinion, will let the newspapers operate independently, but there's always a little bit of pressure. This is just an egregious example of that. I mean, especially with the money to run the newspapers is maybe coming from student activity fees. Sometimes it comes directly from the college. The best ones are those that can support themselves with advertising dollars.
Yeah. How few those are
like
now.
The Daily Orange in Syracuse is one of those, and they are clearly independent, but obviously this was wrong. There was clearly other kinds of news happening that week that should have been included in the newspaper besides homecoming, as important as that is to some people.
Yeah, I think colleges and the college media have always had a tense relationship from the perspective that the colleges figure, hey, there's students here. We have rules that govern the way students behave, and we also control the purse strings very often, as you were mentioning. And now there's additional pressure. There's a risk if a college newspaper or a college media operation were to publicize Palestinian protests or ICE in the local community, ICE agents coming in and raiding local businesses and homes. That would be controversial, and it could end up costing the university federal dollars for this program or that program, and it could actually, you know, cause scrutiny. A lot of these colleges don't get the scrutiny that Harvard, Yale, and Columbia and other big colleges are getting, and they're having fights with the Trump administration over funding of research projects, etc. So they'd like to stay below the radar, and at the same time, they don't want anything controversial, and homecoming tends not to be controversial.
Mostly. Are you telling me that you think that the Trump administration might step in and punish the university if the campus press says something controversial?
Yeah, you know,
shocking.
It would be somebody local or some angry alumni or somebody who felt offended, you know, sort of starting a social media post, and then all that needs is for somebody in high office to see that social media post and retweet it or repost it and give attention to it, and suddenly that university is terrified it's going to lose important dollars that it needs to operate.
You know, it's all part of this complying in advance that we've been so worried about everywhere. Coming down the pike, let's be careful, let's be ultra careful. And, you know, let's not forget how important student newspapers have been out in Stanford. Some of their investigative reporting led to the resignation of the college president. I mean, these can be important places for real news to develop and real journalists to do some serious work. So we need to be mindful of what's happening on those campuses.
Excellent. Speaking of complying in advance, we saw an example of that not happening at the Pentagon. Dozens of reporters within the last few days have turned in their access badges and left the Pentagon rather than agree to restrictions on their work that were imposed by the Trump administration. Pete Hegseth, former weekend Fox News host.
You always have to get that in, don't you?
Second string. Just want to say that he really wants to exercise control over what comes out of the Pentagon. And reporters have said, we're not going to do it. And as you said, even Fox News said, we're not going to do it.
It's heartening to see all the major news organizations, with the exception of ONA, One News America, I think is the name of the organization.
Yeah.
They signed the pledge, and some other individual bloggers and things have signed it. But you get down to the nut of this is that the Pentagon needs to be covered. It's trillions of dollars of American taxpayer money. It's so essential that the public be informed of what's going on. Nobody's talking about reporting during a war of troop movements or anything like that. But I think that reporting of what's going on in the Pentagon and in the military is not going to stop. Reporters have developed sources. They can get access through freedom of information laws about budgets. They can get it from congressional members. Congressional members still have the opportunity, and they can pass along that information and make it public. It is the public's information, after all. But as local news editors, how many times have local entities become angry at reporting by your newspaper and then tell their staff they can no longer talk to the Daily Gazette or the Times Union? I mean, that happens all the time, and you get around it. And I think these reporters will get around it.
It is interesting that we've seen access curtailed here in the state of New York, for example. When I covered the state capitol in the 1980s, we had free access to the second floor where the governor's suite is. That's now only controlled by security. The assembly chamber under Speaker Carl Hastie has significantly restricted reporters' access. Now the area behind the speaker's podium, which used to be a place where you could buttonhole assembly members and staff and talk to them, that's now cut off. So we've seen that kind of access cut back all the time.
You know, part of the Pentagon rules also included the idea that Pentagon personnel were not allowed to talk to the press. Well, we know that here in New York as well. I mean, if you back in the, and when I first started, I could talk to anybody who worked for state government and for stories. Now you have to go through the PR people who talk to the people and relay the information. I mean, that's, that has certainly tightened up. So we've been critical of the White House Correspondents Association because when AP got thrown out for continuing to use the Gulf of Mexico, we on this program did not like the fact that the White House Correspondents Association basically did nothing. I wish they would have had a stronger response in this case as well. They issued a mealy-mouthed kind of short press release saying that's wrong, but I thought this was an opportunity for them to show a little backbone as well, a little more backbone.
Yeah, to be asked to sign a pledge that you will not print something without it being authorized by the Pentagon is just an outrageous trampling of your First Amendment rights. And now he's Secretary Hegseth is also, talking about doing lie detectors on staff if information gets out, and doing, perhaps even wiretapping and other surveillance to catch leakers and punish them. And that just puts a cloud over the whole idea of the First Amendment and freedom of speech and freedom of the press.
This is truly a dark time, isn't it?
Well, it suggests that our government is run by people who are very vulnerable, or snowflakes, I think is the term they used to apply. I think that Hegseth can't handle the heat. That is, of course, the term that they used to use supposedly against the left. But I think we're seeing what snowflakes are. And the president actually says that when he was asked about, they said, we have an option here, too. The press, we could move the press out of the White House. You're lucky I'm president, he says, because we could move you guys out.
But in fact, a lot of established legacy media have lost position in the White House press corps. They don't get the access they once had, and others have moved in and taken their places in the very cramped, White House press area. So it is a definitely a constriction that is recognizing that there is a lot of power by these entities to limit how reporters cover them.
Yeah, I think at this point in time, we need to educate the public more and more about why this is wrong. And it's wrong because this is not how a free and fair democracy operates.
Absolutely. Hey, here's a bit of good news to close on as we get near the end of the program. An assessment of donations to public media in the aftermath of the federal cutoff shows this. In the three-month period, membership revenue, that is, people who have become members of public media stations across the country, has increased 68.6% year over year. New donors, an increase of 200%, and very good news for public media. The number is especially high among millennials, people aged 30 to 44 right now, I think is what millennials are. So this is very good news for the platform that we are on right here, which is public media. And I'm sure that if there were WAMC personnel sitting in the studio with us here, we contributors are here alone, they would say thank you very much. But we thank you, too, for joining us and for being a part of this operation. So that is the Media Project for this week. Mike Spain is here. Thanks for stepping in, Mike. What a great thing.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Wonderful to see you. And Judy Patrick is here, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette.
I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, but I hope that fundraising stat continues.
Hope it continues.
It's not a one-time thing.
That's right, folks. Stay there with us. And I'm Rex Smith. We are grateful to our producer, Dave Gustina, and everybody here at WAMC for making this possible. And we thank you for joining us. Hope you come back again next week for the Media Project.
Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have started.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Mike Spain, former associate editor of the Times Union. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
They all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.